the essence of the meditative attitude. Bring your attention to the breath. You don't want to control or interfere with it. Just breathe normally. What does it feel like? Get nerdily curious about it. The instruction is to notice some part of the sensation of breathing. It might be the feeling of the air at the nostrils, or the feeling of the breath moving into the chest or belly, or even the continuous flow of all these together. Whatever jumps out at you most. The idea is to pay attention to your breathing without trying to control it in any way. If you can bring an attitude of enjoyment to it, all the better. You want to become a connoisseur of breathing, enjoying it the way you'd enjoy the flavors of a good meal. The more you try to connect the subtle enjoyment of a sensation, its softness, its smoothness, the end of each breath, the space in between, the more concentrated you'll become. And it's also okay if you have to fake the interest a bit at first. If you like, take a moment now to notice the feeling of your breath in an easygoing way. To help, you've got the option of doing something called noting. So noting means you silently say to yourself, i.e. you note, in when you breathe in and out when you breathe out. Or you can count breaths, 1, 2, 3, up to 10, and then start at 1 again. It's sort of up to you. Lots of people find that noting helps them stay on track, so it's like the skillful use of thinking to hack thinking. It's like you take over the thinking bandwidth for your own meditative purposes. If you don't like working with the breath, no problem. Choose another sensation, maybe the feeling of your hands, or the feeling of contact with the chair or cushion. You can even use sound if you prefer. Continuous background sounds work really well, like the distant drone of traffic, or the hum of a ceiling fan or a radiator. Lots of objects can work. Choose one, and then stay on it as best you can. Try not to jump around looking for a, quote, better sensation. Any sensation can get weirdly fulfilling with time. See if you can let the simplicity of the activity come as a relief. No 100-item to-do lists, nothing you need to do here, except breathe, or feel, or listen, one breath at a time. How delicately can you feel the sensation, not grabbing at it, or anticipating the next breath while this one is still happening? Just this breath. That's what meditators say, just this breath. Stillness helps. The stiller and more relaxed you are, the clearer the signal. So be curious. This is an exploration. And know that it's totally normal for distractions to come up. No doubt they're already there. Your own commentary and criticisms, aches and pains, unwanted sounds warbling in from the external world. In fact, let's tune in to what I imagine is happening in Dan's mind right now. Jeff's meditation is too long. What were we thinking? I'm losing my rugged good looks. Bianca always looks perfect. Why is that? Maybe I'm aging more quickly. What's that smell? Gas leak. This is what minds do. They like to run with stuff. It's actually quite entertaining. The trick with this meditation is to good-naturedly let all that material be in the background. You don't have to stop it, or chase it, or start analyzing it, even though the urge to do so can be quite mighty. Just let it all play itself out while you stay with the breath. If you do find that a stealthy thought has come up from below and sort of carried you away to another planet, then do one of those cartoon double takes and try to notice what happened. This is the mindfulness part. Where has my mind been? Oh, it was planning, blanking, sexting, fantasizing. Now you know. The move now is to try to let the distraction go in a leisurely and non-uptight way. Return to the breath. So actually, this is a big moment, an important moment. It's not unusual to start judging yourself here, to think about how bad you are as a meditator, and to go off on some catastrophizing tangent about how you're uniquely doomed, etc. Instead, try the opposite. Take a moment to generate a brief sense of satisfaction at having noticed your distraction in the first place. Can you notice the subtle electrical clarity of your mindfulness? It's like, yep, you are here, snapping back into awareness. You can even do this right now as you read this. Notice your own mindful awareness. Snap. It just takes a split second. The appreciation of, quote, waking up, end quote, is one of the rewards that actually really quickly accelerates our capacity to stay mindful. This is the other training we're engaged in here. The training of letting go of distractions, of taking pleasure in being mindful, of beginning again. So, back to your object of concentration. The breath, the sensation, the sound. How into it can you get? Can you breathe like Stevie Wonder plays piano? That dude is into it. So you're breathing normally, but also like it's the softest and most interesting thing going. Like you never noticed before how satisfying it is to breathe. When you're ready, open your eyes. Once you're done with any meditation, it's not a bad idea to take a few minutes to relax with your eyes closed or even to lie down. This seems to help lock in the benefits. Plus, jumping directly into action mode after sitting can be a bit jarring. Okay, so here's the cheat sheet summary. Cheat sheet. 1. Breathe normally. Try to tune into the subtle sensations. If it helps, you can note in as you breathe in and out as you breathe out. If you don't like the breath, choose another body sensation or some regular external sound. 2. Try to enjoy both the feeling and the simplicity of the activity. 3. If your mind wanders, no problem. Just notice what's hijacked you and then return to the breath with a sense of mindful satisfaction. Pro tips. These are little tricks that help make breath meditation easier. Count the breaths from 1 to 10. And then start over. Breathe in 1, then out. Breathe in 2, then out. Etc. Some people like to recite a little phrase to help them stay with what's going on. Just this breath is a good one. It reminds us not to start anticipating the next breath, or to think about the last one, or to imagine in any of the innumerable ways the mind imagines that anything else is supposed to be happening other than exactly what is happening, which is noticing exactly this breath. Just this breath. Repeating this helps soothe and simplify our experience, reminding us again and again not to overcomplicate things. Get forensically curious about the breath. Can you notice the exact moment the breath ends? The exact moment it begins? Can you notice the mysterious little space between breaths? Be like a private investigator of breathing. For particularly busy minds, some teachers recommend the use of touch points. So you breathe in, and then you feel your butt or your hands or whatever. You breathe out, feel your butt, hands, whatever, and so on. The idea is to keep your mind occupied by filling up every possible down moment with a new noticing. Recruit an image. Sometimes I imagine the in-breath as a gentle wave moving up the beach. And on the out-breath, the wave recedes, back and forth. This rhythm can be very entrancing, so make sure to stay mindful. Find an image that works for you. This can be especially helpful if the breath starts to get so subtle that we can barely notice it. It's actually possible this vague image may gradually replace the sensation of breathing and become the new object of focus. If this starts to happen, not a problem, just go with it. Give guided audio meditations a shot. Some people, wrongly, assume that guided audio meditations are a form of cheating or training wheels. I completely disagree. Anyone who's ever meditated will know that even the simplest instructions are quickly forgotten. Having someone in your ear can be really helpful. My advice is to experiment with both audio and solo meditations and see what works for you.
As Jeff was delivering the basic instructions to my GMA colleagues, there was an amusing micro-drama unfolding. Out of the hush, we kept hearing Paula's voice interrupting with questions. I have never seen anyone turn a guided meditation into a call and response before, but it was kind of amazing. I feel like I'm slouching. Is that okay now because I'm relaxing? You can shift, can't you? Then she got to the biggie, the mother of all I-can't-do-this concerns. mind wandering. When I'm feeling a distraction, like I can feel my stomach hanging over or I just heard Ron's stomach growl, what do I do with all of those distractions? Paula was under the sway of one of the central misconceptions that stop people from meditating. The idea that if you get distracted, you're doing it wrong. Here's how Paula summed it up in our post-meditation debrief. I've always thought it was clearing your brain of everything. The dreaded clear your head myth is responsible for untold numbers of aborted meditation careers. I hear people espousing this faulty belief all the time. I know I should meditate, they tell me, but I can't stop thinking. People tend to assume they are distinctively distractible, that they exhibit a sui generis kind of lunacy that prevents them and only them from ever meditating. I call this the fallacy of uniqueness, and Paula is the perfect mascot. I mean, I literally have switched positions 25 times since we've been talking, she told us. I cannot sit still. I have a similar thing as a kind of agitated, hyperactive person, Jeff said. I'll just sit and I'll feel all the energy swirling around like a deranged chipmunk. So I have a chipmunk inside of me? Asked Paula. Yes, you've got a chipmunk inside of you. The truth is, we all have chipmunks. We are all nuts. You cannot hear this enough. Meditation does not require you to stop thinking. If you go into meditation with the expectation that you will suspend all thought, you are going to have a rough go of it. Meditation is unlike anything else you do in life, in that here, quote-unquote, failing, that is, noticing you've gotten distracted and starting again, is succeeding. When you wake up from distraction, that is the magic moment, the victory. And it is a victory of real consequence. You are achieving the first big insight of meditation. It's a zoo inside of your skull. Why is this important? Because the more you see all this clamor, the less likely you are to be controlled by it. You are no longer trapped inside your thoughts. You're momentarily stepping outside of them, watching with a combination of horror and amusement and curiosity. The fact that humans can do this is astounding and probably should be taught in grade school because, as Jeff likes to argue, it points to an inner geography that is a lot more fundamental than the names of our state capitals. There is no question that for beginning meditators, it can be really intimidating to behold the sheer magnitude of the inner craziness. It can also be wearisome to have to start over and over and over. But just know this is exactly what is supposed to happen. It means you are doing it right. You don't have to reach a special state. Getting lost and starting over is meditation, at least at first. And it's also important to know that it gets easier with time. Bear in mind that you are building a new skill here. I'm always struck by how quickly people conclude that they can't meditate. If I handed you a flute, you wouldn't expect that you could rock the flute solo of a Jethro Tull song immediately. Likewise, the first time you meditate, don't expect radiant clarity. So again, you don't have to stop thinking. You just have to change your relationship to your thinking. In fact, you can learn to change your relationship to all the mental Visigoths reaving and roving through your head, including thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations. The name for the new kind of relationship you can create with the contents of your consciousness is equanimity. This is Jeff's all-time favorite word. In fact, he had recently started an email newsletter called The Equanimist. I had been rooting for the Age of Equanimus. In the room with Paula, Jeff explained, equanimity is the capacity to let your experience be what it is without trying to fight it and negotiate with it. It's like an inner smoothness or frictionlessness. When Jeff's inner chipmunk was active, he explained, he had developed the ability through meditation to sit back and, quote, just let it all play out. It's kind of like you're getting a little inner massage with your agitation. It stops becoming a thing that's bugging you and starts becoming a thing that you're mildly and affectionately curious about, like some little critter in your body. Equanimity was enormously attractive to Paula, who felt pulled in a million directions in her life. Balancing her three young children with her more than full-time job, aside from anchoring the weekend editions of GMA, she's also a co-host of The View and a reporter for many of our major broadcasts. What I'm really looking for is level-headedness, she said. Jeff assured her that this was exactly what meditation is designed to help with. the ability to handle your challenges, both inner and outer, more sanely. It's sort of like whack-a-mole, you know? In life, normally, you're like, whack, 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 he said, pantomiming a kid frenziedly whacking varmints with a mallet. But with meditation, you're more like dumb, 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 he said, this time wielding the mallet in a decidedly more mellow manner. It's like you're in a reggae band instead of an 80s synth band. It doesn't change your circumstances, said Paula. It just changes your reaction to those circumstances. Correct, I exclaimed. That's brilliantly said. I love this stuff. There is nothing more thrilling than seeing the lights go on for someone, especially someone you care about. The important point about thinking is that you can disembed from it and watch it play out without feeding it. Because the issue of compulsive overthinking is so common, here's a tailored meditation from Jeff.
So one of the excellent and admittedly quite counterintuitive mindfulness skills we're learning is the ability to distinguish between thinking and awareness. To use a classic metaphor from consciousness studies, awareness is like the empty stage. Thinking is one of the actors that trots out onto that stage, along with seeing, hearing, tasting, and touching. When we're mindful, we watch thinking play out from the vantage of awareness. So awareness is the wider perspective. Most people don't realize it's the wider perspective because thinking feels so similar to awareness. It's perfectly camouflaged. But when we actually start to pay attention to thinking, we can begin to notice the ghostly details of this very important actor. We begin to notice that actually thinking is tangible. It's trackable. It's made up of vague, fleeting images and tumbling inner talk and sudden ideas and tugs of emotion that play out as sensations in the body. When we're thinking, we may even notice a bit of subtle tension in our face and body as each thought performs its part. Fortunately, we can learn to pan back the camera and notice when any of this is happening. To use the metaphor Dan invoked earlier, we can reclaim our place behind the waterfall. And by the way, this move doesn't prevent us from thinking. It just lets us choose whether we want to reinforce a particular thought soliloquy or not. And the hilarious thing here is thinking itself often tries to convince us of how important it is. And sometimes it is. But other times it's unreliable and filled with unnecessary drama. Drama that actually prevents us from seeing what's really going on. The line I like is, thinking is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. This understanding gets clear the longer we practice. So for this meditation, we're going to stay working with the breath. The feeling of our breath is going to be the focus, or some other home-based sensation or sound. But we're going to keep an internal eye on our thinking and try to notice the moment thinking starts to steal the show. In this way, we slowly learn to counter our lifelong habit of indulging every single thought. Catching thinking in the act, a meditation. 5 to 10 minutes, although you can also do this meditation in under a minute. There are always thoughts to catch. Start by taking a couple of deep breaths. On the inhale, you can stretch up your spine a bit, and on the exhale, you imagine you're breathing out any tension, softening the body as you settle down into the chair or the cushion. The first thing we do is set our attitude, a sense of good-naturedness and affability in the way we sit, not uptight. Curious about this practice, inquisitive about our capacity to be with the breath, but also open to learning about our mysterious and charming thinking process. So the basic instruction is the same as in our first meditation. Focus on the feeling of the in and the out breath. Decide the sensation you want to focus on. Maybe the feeling of air tickling the nostrils, or the feeling of air moving into the chest, or maybe the tautness of the abdomen as it rises on the inhale. Choose one of these sources of sensation and then commit to it, seeing if you can tune in to the softness and subtleties of the breath. Many people like to use a little note to help them pay attention. So in, out, or rising, falling. If you do this, let the tone of your noting be calm. at whatever pacing works for you. So breathing in, breathing out, aware of the sensations, aware you are breathing, mindfulness of breathing. If focusing on your breath is psyching you out for any reason, then choose another sensation to work with. The feeling of your hands, the contact of your seat on the chair or cushion, maybe a point in the belly, or even external sounds. Whatever you choose, the idea is to then commit your attention, lightly and in a friendly way, not straining to make anything happen. As we progress, it's almost inevitable that we'll forget the breath and find ourselves off thinking about something. Thoughts can be ridiculously subtle. They come up underneath us and carry us away, and before we know it, we realize that for the past 2 minutes we've been fantasizing about walking through a field of golden grass at sunset, holding hands with the multi-platinum recording artist Josh Groban. At least, if we happen to be Dan Harris.
Busted. I am actually thinking about Josh Groban right now.
The point is, there's nothing more normal in the world. The mind secretes thoughts the way the stomach secretes digestive enzymes. It's part of our body's natural functioning. The key for our purposes, as always, is mindfulness. Being able to notice when this has happened, so we can catch our thoughts in the act. Each time we notice, we wake up. To help with this, we'll use a little note. Thinking. We say it with friendliness and appreciation, because thinking really can be quite mischievous and wily. And then, we go right back to feeling the breath. In, out. In, out. In, image in Dan's mind of Josh Groban pulling him up on stage, his heart leaps. Me? Is it true? Oh, I'm thinking. Notice that you got hijacked there for a sec. Notice what it's like, snap, to wake up, to escape thinking's weird gravity. If you're noting it, thinking, then you're not inside it. So appreciate this tiny moment of sanity, and then return to the breath. Aware you're breathing. In, out. In, out. And so it goes. Never annoyed by our excitable thinking process. Rather, we're curious, exploring how soon we can notice that thinking has taken over. Building up this weird new skill of internal discernment, fine-tuning our sensitivity, our mindfulness. In, out. When you feel ready, or when the timer goes off, you can open your eyes and head back into your day. As you do, see if you can tune in occasionally to your thinking process. Try to notice when it's carried you away, and also get curious about that exact moment of waking up. What does this moment feel like? Can you notice the contrast between being embedded within the humid interior of your thinking, and then coming up and out into the more open field of awareness? I can't say enough about how important this is. Again and again, we can wake up from the comparatively narrow trance of our preoccupations into a wider and more spacious perspective. We can learn to live in this place, appreciative of the action, dipping it as needed, but not beholden to any of it. In this way, we get more present, more free, and more available to life. Cheat sheet. 1. Breathe normally and try to tune into the sensations of breathing. Let it be enjoyable and relaxed. 2. If you find that thinking swept you away, note thinking, and then return to feeling and noting the breath. 3. See if you can appreciate thinking's subtle ability to entrance without feeding or indulging in the actual content of the thoughts. Get curious about the exact moment of waking up from distraction.
One last note on our encounter with my GMA colleagues. As I was holding forth to the gang about the evils of the clear the mind myth and cheering on Paula for her emerging understanding of the concept of equanimity, I was struck by an unfortunate irony. This was the moment when I realized I had been a huge hypocrite, albeit an accidental one. A few years ago, I had my meditation skills tested by neuroscientists. Specifically, they were examining my ability to shut down what's called the default mode network, DMN, of the brain. the regions that fire when we're thinking about ourselves, ruminating about the past, or projecting into the future. Instead of tamping down the DMN, I was achieving the exact opposite. Mine was lit up like a Christmas tree. The problem? Apparently, I was ignoring my own advice. Rather than gently starting over when I got distracted, I was getting all overheated and self-lacerating about the inevitable wanderings of the mind. It would go a little bit like this. Look, I can pun in French. I've got a soupçon that soupçon. Did you know that a group of chipmunks is called a scurry, and it's a dray of squirrels and a business of ferrets and... Seriously? What in tarnation is the matter with you? After spending years assuring people that the whole game in meditation is just to begin again, it turns out I was mouthing the words without truly absorbing their significance. It reminded me of how my 2-year-old son, Alexander, would walk around the house repeating our disciplinary injunctions. Be careful, he would cry as he was knocking over a lamp, or no circles as he whirled like a dervish. And my favorite, the sing-songy no, 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 as he inched his hand toward the electrical sockets. In my defense, it's hard to relax when you have a tangle of wires attached to your skull while being scrutinized by a team of researchers. Still, the results were humbling. I think my problem stemmed in part from the very first time I had heard the basic meditation instructions. I had cockily assumed that I could win at meditation and therefore wouldn't ever need to gently begin again. That was for other people, I reckoned. Imagine my surprise. The larger issue, however, was quite literally in my genes. Paula and Jeff may have struggled primarily with their inner chipmunks, but my principal hobgoblin was an entirely different beast, my inner Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson was my grandfather, my mom's dad. He looms in my mind as a fearsome figure. He was a cranky old goat, a dyed-in-the-wool curmudgeon, and an unreconstructed fussbudget. He also bore a striking resemblance to the man with the pitchfork in the famous painting American Gothic. He was incredibly smart, but also wildly insecure, which could make him unpleasant, to say the least. He was raised by a bitter and violence-prone dairy farmer in upstate New York and grew up to be a disgruntled middle manager at the Yellow Pages with 5 kids of his own. While Robert himself was never physically abusive, his temper was volcanic and unpredictable. I remember once when he somehow found out that I had gently made fun of him in a letter to my parents that I had sent home from summer camp. He promptly disinvited my mother from her own sister's wedding, which was being held in Robert's backyard. He also refused to speak to her for a year. That penchant for paranoia and grudge nursing had undeniably found its way into my bloodstream. It was my inheritance from Robert Johnson. He could emerge in bolts of self-righteous fury when I felt wronged at work or at home. He could be unleashed on hapless call center employees who didn't deliver immediate satisfaction. In fairness, by this point in my life, Robert Johnson was making vastly fewer appearances thanks to meditation, maturation, and marriage, but he was still there waiting to be coaxed out of his shadowy psychic demimonde. I saw him quite frequently, in fact, when I would get distracted during meditation. I would wake up from some sort of mid-meditation daydream and Bobby J. would come rushing in. You are as useful as a jar of guano. You have all the personality of a wall sconce, all the sophistication of a spork, all the cultural heft of a Hoobastank record. On this Sunday morning, the first day of our road trip, R.J. was in full effect. I was exhausted from having been up since 3:45 a.m. I was stressed about all the interviews we needed to get done that day, and I was preemptively missing my wife and son. I noticed a petty biliousness in my inner monologue. I was criticizing myself. Why'd you eat so much last night? Now your face is puffy and you'll look bad on all the video we're shooting. I was internally henpecking Jeff. What the hell is he doing using highfalutin terms like figure ground reversal and parasympathetic response? And I was getting pissed about unimportant things, like the fact that breakfast showed up late. Like, really pissed. Like, anger coursing through veins. It felt awful. It wasn't just anger. I was also feeling anxious. I was going on huge jags of what the Buddhists call prapancha. I'm not normally one to drop random ancient Indian words, especially in a book designed for fidgety skeptics, but prapancha is just too useful and interesting a concept to leave out. Prapancha is when something bad happens in the present moment, a stray comment, a bit of bad news, a stubbed toe, whatever, and you immediately extrapolate to some catastrophic future. My prapancha runs would go like this. The singer Josh Groban is supposed to come in later today for an on-camera meditation lesson with me and Jeff, but his publicist seems a bit nervous about it. This encounter is going to be unsuccessful. In fact, this whole trip is going to be a mess. I will be exposed as a fraud. I will end up teaching jazzercise at a strip mall in Ronkonkoma, New York. After our interview with my GMA co-anchors, the person in charge of filming the road trip, Eddie Boyce, asked me and Jeff to walk through the halls of ABC News so he could record us discussing our first interaction of the journey. I turned what was supposed to be a post-mortem on our meditation chat into an extended aria about my own issues. It's already been such a long day for me, I said, getting up at 3:45 and then having to manage all of my colleagues and everybody from the company and you. I was also worried about the fact that my wife was due to come in for an interview and she wasn't feeling well. That's a lot, said Jeff with uncontrived empathy. I'm definitely more triggered than I normally am, I said. When that stuff is all happening, do you find you are able to connect to the meditative principles, he asked. Yeah, I am, I said, more or less. I notice it, and then I try not to be too carried away by it. That's the main thing to do, said Jeff, but he then went on to make a key point, one that I largely missed. He said that when he personally was feeling stressed and overwhelmed, he not only tried to see his emotions clearly, but also this, quote, can I do it in a way that's sort of more generous? Meditation teachers talk about this all the time. It's not enough just to see what's happening in your mind clearly so that it doesn't yank you around. You should also hold it all with some warmth. Many teachers use terms such as loving kindness and self-compassion. Jeff, at least, used a less syrupy word, friendliness. While I knew intellectually that he was on to something, I pretty much brushed past it. Why? Because I'm Robert Johnson's grandson, goddammit. I did not stop complaining, though. The next thing Eddie, our director, wanted to film was a solo interview with me in which he would ask about my hopes and fears for the coming trip. What are you most afraid of on the bus tour? Asked Eddie. You're packing in with 12 people on a small bus. I'm an anxious guy, so there are a number of things I'm afraid of. My kid has a fever right now, and I'm worried that somehow I'm going to get sick and then infect everybody. Also, I want people to get along. I don't want to work people too hard. I want to make sure we get good material for the book and the app. We really have no idea what we're getting ourselves into. There's no precedent for this. It's not like, hey, we're modeling it on the Great Meditation Tour of 77. Eddie looked on sympathetically. He'd been a meditator since he was 8 years old, raised in a Buddhist community, to the cushion born, as it were. It is undoubtedly part of what imbues him with his casual cool. In his 40s, he still looks like a film student with his big glasses, neat beard, and fitted sweaters. He writes poetry and religiously reads The New Yorker. And yet, there's something boyishly unpretentious and accessible about him. He's the kind of guy who goes surfing in the winter nearly every day in Nova Scotia, where he lives with his wife and kids. As an aside, when somebody told me once that Eddie used to hang out and talk skateboarding with the Beastie Boys back in the 90s, I was entirely unsurprised. Eddie had started doing freelance video production for the 10% Happier app a few months prior and had revolutionized our content with his creative ideas. In fact, he was the one who had come up with the whole road trip concept. By complete coincidence, Eddie and Jeff happened to be old friends. They went to college together. When it was Jeff's turn to do his solo interview, he too voiced some concerns about the coming trip. I worry that the crew are going to get totally exhausted, that there will be some sort of collective nervous breakdown. I feel like Ed's got his stuff pretty well together, so we'll see. Jeff also had some personal concerns, so at least I wasn't the only one feeling neurotic. My energy gets up and my attention gets totally blown out, he said, referring to those times when he gets so carried away by his enthusiasm and erudition that his mouth can barely keep up with his mind. I'm worried that will happen on this trip, that I'll get super excited about stuff and get emotionally dysregulated and start saying and doing ridiculous shit. The fact that both Jeff and I had these active neuroses was deeply comforting to my wife, Bianca. It wasn't that she enjoyed our suffering, well, maybe mine just a tiny bit, but hearing that experienced meditators still struggle with these emotions helped alleviate her "I can't do this" fears. She met us in my office. She and I were sitting on my couch with Jeff positioned across from us on a straight back chair. It felt a bit like we'd signed up for couples therapy. I had been worried about whether Bianca would be up for doing this interview. She had a cold, was exhausted from being on the graveyard shift with our son, and was managing her perennial discomfort with being on camera. Nonetheless, she was in fine fettle. If she were not my wife, it would have been seriously annoying that she could look so pulled together in her artfully frayed jeans and sporty white zip-up sweatshirt, even when objectively impaired. It was ironic that Bianca was not a regular meditator. You would think a doctor would understand the importance of self-care. Moreover, she was the one who had gotten me started on all of this by giving me a book on the subject. In case you're curious, it was called Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart by Dr. Mark Epstein, whom I subsequently forced to become my friend and meditative mentor. Bianca's own personal practice was hindered, though, by a complicated bouillabaisse of obstacles, which we will explore later in this book. As you will see, Jeff, in full MacGyver mode, came up with a rather ingenious fix. For now, though, suffice it to say that she, too, wrestled with the fear of not doing it right. As she told Jeff in my office, "I certainly have high expectations for myself. If I can't do it well, then I'm not going to do it." However, hearing Jeff and me discuss our own struggles, even after being meditators for many years, helped put some cracks in her perfectionism. Turning to me, she said, "Obviously, you're much more successful in managing your emotions than you were before, but every now and then it will pop up." In my bad old days, pre-meditation, I had a real temper. Our marital spats were more frequent and vehement. I would carry my stress home from work and too often come in the door scowling and irritable. Although Bianca said I still had a resting face that was a little stern, my bouts of anger these days were exceedingly rare. Neither of us could remember the last time I had raised my voice. On the couch, though, I felt compelled to admit my current ill humor. "Right now I'm in a shit mood," I said. "But I couldn't tell," she said. "Anyway, the point is to know that people can be experienced and still be imperfect. It's very useful." The fact that the person who knew me best in the world couldn't tell I was in a bad mood was incredibly reassuring. I might have been dealing with a raging internal Robert Johnson, but I wasn't acting on it. It reminded me of an expression I had heard Jeff use about the way emotions manifest in long-term meditators: hurt more, suffer less. In other words, while meditation may mean you feel your irritation or impatience more acutely, it is less likely to stick around and you are less likely to act on it, to turn it into true suffering for yourself and others. As we were wrapping up our chat, Bianca had some words of advice for Jeff when it came to living at close quarters with me for 11 days. "He doesn't really pick up the clothes, just so you know. Like being a teenager," he said. "A little bit," she replied. By early evening, we were sitting in a radio studio at ABC News awaiting the arrival of Josh Groban. Josh and I had come into each other's Twitter orbit a few weeks before when I noticed that Josh had retweeted one of my many daily pro-meditation missives. I tweeted back, "Do you meditate?" He replied, "Still trying to meditate without wanting to throw a lamp across the room." He seemed like the perfect test case for the meditation MacGyver. Josh arrived at the appointed hour, having walked directly off a Broadway stage where he was starring in a new play called Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. It was, of all things, a modern musical update of War and Peace, and Josh was getting rave reviews for his performance as the male lead. He had a full-on bushy beard, as the role required, and was wearing a black knit winter hat and dark sweater. He was just as friendly in person as you might think by watching him in his many television appearances. We were recording this interview so that later it could be included on my podcast. We were also putting it out live on Facebook. I began the interview by saying, "We haven't met formally, and you probably don't remember this, but we actually were next to each other at the urinals backstage at Good Morning America one day." "How could I forget?" he said, I didn't peek, just so you know, I added. I asked him why he was intrigued by the notion of meditation, and he was bracingly frank. Ever since he had been signed to his first record deal as a teenager, he said, anxiety and expectation have played a huge part in my existence. I had a huge amount of pressure on me very, very early on. I had a lot of people around me that made it very clear to me how life or death each little thing was as far as the trajectory of my career. Now that he was 35, he said, those quote-unquote angsty beginnings were still showing up in his life, causing him stress. The idea of meditation for me was really about centering and really about seeing my life and seeing the world in a wider capacity, because I get very narrow focused on things when anxiety kicks in. In my view, it was incredibly cool and brave for him to admit his anxiety publicly. When Jeff proposed that we try to meditate, however, I thought I saw a moment of hesitation in Josh's eyes, which, of course, set off my own anxiety. I started to worry that maybe we were forcing him into a live meditation he really didn't want to do. Jeff proceeded to lead a great meditation, but I could hardly follow his instructions because I was practically vibrating with prapancha. Josh Groban is going to launch a Twitter war against me. Everybody loves Groban. I can never prevail in this battle. Strap on your leotard, motherfucker. Jazzercise. But when it was over, Josh was totally psyched. That was great, he said. That was wonderful. It was clear he had experienced something of a breakthrough. He had realized that he could, in fact, meditate without throwing a lamp across the room. It was interesting, he said to Jeff. As you were saying the things, you were saying them right when I needed to hear them. I think the thing that would make me frustrated in the past is that the control freak in me would kick in. I would notice myself wandering or not doing it right, and then I'd get frustrated. At that point, I would be thinking to myself, okay, I've just got to stop now because I'm just getting frustrated with myself. I think the friendliness aspect, the understanding that you're thinking those things and that's okay and finding ways to bring it back is good. Damn, I was thinking. I've been meditating for 8 years and this guy, who's been meditating for like 8 minutes, has already keyed in on the whole friendliness thing. Jeff added another important point about giving yourself a break during meditation. When you get frustrated like that, which is a normal response, what you're basically training your subconscious to say is that, oh wow, this guy's frustrated now. Best not to even notice at all when your mind has wandered. It actually makes you wander more often. This was the point I had personally ignored to my detriment. The most important thing to do when you notice your mind wander is to feel satisfaction that you noticed it in the first place. It is basic behavioral science. If you make waking up from distraction rewarding, you train the mind to do it more often. I would imagine this takes practice, right? Asked Josh. Absolutely, Jeff assured him. It's okay that it takes practice, said Josh. That is the practice, replied Jeff. It was hard to call this anything other than a huge win. We had just witnessed Josh Groban grasp meditation in one quick conversation. I was filled with relief and gratitude. You're my anxious half-Jewish brother, I exclaimed. Let's get a drink, he said. It was all going so well, except as we were saying our goodbyes, Jeff did one of those namaste bows that drive me nuts. I think of it as coming to center, he said, leaning forward, his hands in prayer position. When I'm doing this, I imagine I'm gathering in everything and there's a still point in the center and I bow to the still point. Oy, Jeffrey. I came home from our interview with Josh and found that Bianca had laid out a picnic sushi feast on our living room floor. The kid was in bed. My wife and I sat, chatted, and watched TV before my long journey, which would begin in earnest the next morning. It had been a good day. Not even Robert Johnson could deny that. We had found many effective rebuttals for the "I can't do this" fear. The impossibility of perfection, the simplicity of just beginning again, the power of friendliness. Even if I myself still failed to fully comprehend it. Tomorrow, though, we would board our bus, hit the road, and confront the thorniest obstacle to meditation of them all. Time. Chapter 3. I don't have time for this. The next morning, I was in the bathroom scrolling through my emails, enjoying what I thought might be my last visit for a while to a non-rest stop throne, when my phone rang. The caller ID said Elvis Duran. Morning, I said, somewhat formally, not knowing who exactly was going to be on the other end of the line. You're on the radio. We're talking about you. It was Elvis himself, the host of the number one top 40 morning radio show in America, his unmistakable deep voice resonating through the speaker on my phone and simultaneously out to millions of listeners, all as I sat there helplessly indisposed. Shit. I mean, not literally, but shit. I had first met Elvis 3 years earlier, shortly after my first book came out. One day, my Twitter feed was suddenly clogged with people telling me that someone named Elvis Duran had talked about 10% Happier on his radio show. I noticed my sales rank on Amazon, which, and I'm not proud of this, I had gotten in the habit of checking compulsively, go through the roof. I told Bianca about this, mentioning that I had never heard of the guy, and she looked at me like I was crazy. Are you kidding? She said, I love Elvis Duran. I've been listening to him since I was a kid. A few weeks later, I went on his show. It was one of the only interviews I have ever done where Bianca insisted on joining. I was immediately impressed by Elvis. He was a stocky 50-something with salt-and-pepper hair and very clearly not your usual morning shock jock. He is openly gay, and the two most prominent figures in his large crew of on-air personalities are women. The team members are nice to one another as well as to the guests, and they do all of this while still managing to be very, very funny. I was so taken with Elvis that I decided to do a Nightline profile on him, during which I came to like him even more. I learned that while professionally he rubs elbows with people like Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber, he is more comfortable hanging out at home on the couch with his longtime boyfriend Alex, a zookeeper from Staten Island. In part, it's because he's shy. I'm not a glamorous person at all, he told me. I just don't fit in. But it was also because, at the time, he was deeply insecure about his weight. In fact, during our interview, he revealed that he planned to have a kind of bariatric procedure known as the gastric sleeve, where they take out 85% of your stomach. I haven't seen my penis, he said, peering down over his paunch, laughing. Can you see my penis and describe it to me? As surprised as I was by the early morning in the bathroom phone call, I was also, pun not intended, relieved. I had been worrying about something related to Elvis. A few weeks earlier, I had asked his team whether it would be okay if my crew came to his Tribeca studio to shoot behind the scenes on day two of our meditation tour, because I thought that, like GMA, it would be a chaotic, counterintuitive environment in which to talk about the practice. However, I did not want Elvis to feel obliged to put me on the air. And yet, here I was, on the air. Why can't you be interviewed? Asked Elvis. What's your deal? When are you coming in? Say no more. Now I was all in. Put me on the radio, I said. I'll talk as much as you want. I showered and grabbed the new winter coat my wife had bought me for the trip. Bianca and Alexander came out of the bedroom to send me off. A kiss for Bianca, a groggy snuggle with Alexander, and then I hopped in a cab and headed downtown. I got off the elevator at Elvis's studio and walked into the spacious reception area. The 10% Happier team, including Jeff, Ben Rubin, the CEO of the 10% Happier app, and the camera crew, was already assembled on the other side of the room. As I began heading in their direction, though, someone grabbed me by the sleeve and pulled me right into the studio. I was whisked to a seat with a microphone and handed a headset. Dan Harris from ABC News, intoned Elvis. Why are you here on our show? Because you guys are out of your minds, I said, still a little dazed but trying to be at least somewhat witty. Every morning I listen to the show. It's a cry for help. Elvis was barely recognizable after his surgery. He'd always been a handsome fellow, but now, at nearly half his old weight, he looked transformed. He was seated, wearing a black hoodie, at his normal perch in the center of a large U-shaped table, a metallic arm dangling a golden mic in front of his face. He was surrounded by three male producers who were constantly handing him notes, prompts for jokes, information about callers, texts and tweets from some of the 7 million listeners who were reacting to the show in real time. In front of him, seated at a rectangular table, were his two female co-hosts. Elvis steered the conversation to meditation, mentioning that he had recently resumed his practice, which he often did in the early morning before work with his dog Max in his lap. "I'm finding in my life that I'm seeing a change," he said. "I used to get mad and throw chairs." "You've actually thrown chairs?" I asked, genuinely surprised. "I used to break chairs," he assured me. It's easy to forget that despite his relaxed, on-air persona, Elvis runs a complex operation, a show syndicated in 80 markets with a large staff consisting of lively personalities. Now that he was meditating again, he said, "I do stop and think things through a little more. I am more mindful about people around me and what they're saying. I try to be fair, and I try to be the peacekeeper when I can. I'm still moody," he allowed. "I'm still an awful bitch." After some more chatter, he opened up for callers. This would be our first chance on the road trip to hear from the masses. The very first question was both extremely important and entirely unsurprising. "Does it need to be a 10-minute session, a 15-minute session?" asked Brian, a high school health teacher. "How long does it take?" This is almost always the first question I get when I speak to people about meditation. Once they grasp the benefits of the practice and realize that it doesn't require clearing the mind, the next big question is, how the hell do I fit this into my schedule? When it comes to finding the time to meditate, I have good news and even better news. The good news is that meditation does not need to take up much of your time. "I think it's great to start with 5 to 10 minutes a day," I told Brian. The general consensus among teachers and scientists seems to be that if you do 5 to 10 minutes every day, you should be able to derive many of the benefits. And here's the better news. If 5 minutes seems like too much for you, 1 minute also counts. In fact, not only does 1 minute count, it can be extremely powerful. Getting on the cushion, to use a meditative term of art, is the hardest part of the habit formation process, and the proposition of a single minute is uniquely unintimidating and scalable. So if the easiest way for you to establish a daily habit is to start with 1 minute, then go for it. My view, and that of my team, is that, especially at the beginning, consistency is more important than duration. "The goal is to engineer a daily collision with the a-hole in your head," I explained to Brian, "and then when that a-hole gives you bad ideas, you're better able to resist him." This 1 minute counts tack is a new one for me. For many years, I had been somewhat stridently recommending that people start with 5 to 10 minutes a day. My usual argument was, "I don't care if you have 17 jobs and 25 kids, you've got 5 to 10 minutes a day. How much time do you spend watching TV, checking social media? Is it more than 5 minutes? Well, then you definitely have time to meditate." I loved to quote the Harvard physician, Dr. Sanjeev Chopra, "Everyone should meditate once a day, and if you don't have time to meditate, then you should do it twice a day." I have come to see, however, that this approach is a bit out of touch. To be clear, I really do believe, and Jeff is with me on this, that 5 to 10 minutes a day of meditation is a reasonable and achievable goal. The fact is, the more you do, the more you'll get out of it. Within reason, of course. No one's arguing you should do 12 hours a day, unless you want to go really big and attend a meditation retreat. Even though I maintain that it's mathematically hard to defend the notion that you don't have the time, I have had to acknowledge that in our overtaxed, overscheduled, overstimulated era, the perception of time starvation is very real. I have also learned, through my work with the app company, how difficult the process of establishing a new habit can be. What follows are 9 super practical pro tips grounded in scientific research around habit formation as well as the messy reality of daily life. You don't have to do all of these, of course. Just try the ones that seem promising to you. The most important thing to know about behavior change is that there are no silver bullets. The best way to approach it is with a spirit of experimentation. Try things out and then be willing to fail and get back on the horse. Pro tip: grit won't do the trick. You need rewards. One thing we know from the science is that willpower alone will not get you over the hump. Willpower is an unreliable inner resource that tends to evaporate quickly, especially when you get hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. 4 classic discipline-killing conditions, often combined in the acronym HALT. A better strategy is to tap into the benefits. Humans are motivated by rewards. best to co-opt the pleasure centers of the brain if you want to create a sustainable habit. This became abundantly clear when Jeff and I pulled aside Bethany Watson, one of Elvis's co-hosts, for an interview. We set up our cameras to chat with Bethany, a 30-something aspiring actress, in a corner of the reception area outside the studio. I had always been struck by how intelligent, open, and likable Bethany is. As I learned in our chat, though, beneath her easy laugh and fashionable exterior lurks something darker. I have an anxiety disorder, she told us. I'm constantly anxious. Her baseline anxiety, she said, is only exacerbated by her job, which is thrilling but stressful. You're on all the time, she said. There can be no radio silence. You always need to have something clever to add to the conversation. And everyone's worried about whether the boss is in a bad mood. It was a little like being on GMA, only more hectic. No teleprompter, no net. And then there are all those text messages from listeners, which can get nasty. At every moment, you have constant judgments on your person, basically, asked Jeff. Yeah, said Bethany. It's not just the voice in your own head, I began. It's the voice in everyone else's head, said Jeff, jumping in. We were already completing each other's sentences. That's intense. It's like being inside a single neurotic brain, he said. Yeah, it is, Bethany said. But when we asked her why she doesn't meditate, she threw the time card. It's just that I'm so busy every single day, she said, pointing out that she did the Elvis show for 4 hours a morning and then went straight into a full day of acting classes. So then when you come home and you're exhausted, where do you find the time to sit for even 5 minutes? When we pressed her, though, she made an interesting admission. I think the real reason I'm not doing it is because I haven't fully committed to making it a priority. This is not uncommon. Sometimes when people say they don't have time to meditate, they're actually pointing to a whole panoply of unspoken reservations, some of them quite profound. This is where reward comes in. Initially, Jeff tried to sell the reward thusly. Ultimately, meditation's about enjoying your beingness. To which Bethany nodded politely and uncomprehendingly. Her expression kind of reminded me of when my son tries to share his toys with our cats, or that time when I jokingly offered Bianca a tramp stamp for her 40th birthday. Soon enough, however, we got to an extremely clear and compelling potential benefit for Bethany, one that was staring her directly in the face, relief from anxiety. She simply needed to make a more solid connection between meditation and said relief. For example, she knew, and her therapist agreed, that when she exercised, her anxiety was mitigated. We notice a change in my anxiety levels when I haven't worked out for a while, so I have to make that time. That's what it would have to be with meditation, she acknowledged. Bingo. I knew there was a decent probability this could work for Bethany because it had worked for me. Fending off anxiety and depression has been a huge part of what drives me to keep both exercising and meditating. When I'm covering a breaking news story and I don't have as much time to meditate, I notice that the voice in my head gets louder, more obnoxious, and harder to ignore. That's my motivator, I told Bethany. However, humans often need more superficial motivators to help us overcome inertia and indiscipline. Bethany led us in a brainstorming session on features we could build into the app that might help people get started. If there was some sort of present at the end, she mused, specifically she was thinking of a discount card to Nordstrom. It might have to be that shallow initially. No, that's great, I said. I would do it for cookies, for example. Or maybe there's some negative incentive, said Jeff. $20 would be taken out of your bank account and given to your worst enemy if you don't do it. Punishment systems. I could see Ben, my hard-nosed, financially prudent young CEO, squirming nervously a few feet out of the camera range as we tossed around these deeply impractical ideas. More seriously, Bethany offered, I need a visual representation of how far I've come. Like a progress line that shows up on your phone, she said, or starbursts that fill your screen if you complete a certain amount of days. This seemed to calm Ben down. After we wrapped the interview, Bethany headed off to the bathroom. Minutes later, she came rushing back to us with the coup de grace. Okay, I have an idea, she said. What if there was a kitten that I had to keep alive by meditating every day? On the app, I asked. On the app, like a little kitten, and every time you meditated, he got a little stronger, and then if you didn't meditate, he withered. That would keep me meditating. The cartoon little paws. The adorable big eyes, I added. I want a white one with two different colored eyes. I turned to Ben, who was now doing full-body contortions. Do we have the technology to build that, Ben? Too much right now, he said, chuckling and holding his hand up as if to physically repel the idea. We'll look at it.